Hi, everyone. This is Judy Warner with Altium's On Track podcast. Welcome back. We are glad to have you. Remember to connect with us on all the usual social media platforms. I'm at Altium Judy. Please connect with me on LinkedIn. And of course, Altium is on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. And don't forget that we record these simultaneously on YouTube as well. So take a look at our channel on YouTube. So today what we wanted to do is just to chime in and tell you we're going to have a break. So for about 6 weeks, we're going to take a break because we are busy, busy, busy here at Altium preparing for all the Altium live events in San Diego and in Munich. San Diego has just passed and we had an unbelievable, really positive time. We had keynote speakers like Eric Bogatin, Rick Hartley, Jeremy Blum, Bill Hurd. In all, we had about 30 speakers, 16 sponsors, and are you ready for it? Over 300 attendees on the beautiful beach in San Diego. We'll be able to actually do the same thing over again with a different set of faces and speakers, and we'll be doing that in Munich, Germany, January 15th through 17th. So if you are in Europe or in the Munich area, please, please join us. You won't want to miss it. Two other things besides all the great technical content that we offered at Altium Live was we rolled out a groundbreaking program product that's called Altium 365. Altium 365 is a cloud-based platform where you can collaborate not only with your adjacent, say your engineer, but you can talk to all the stakeholders in the process, whether that's component folks, fabrication, assembly, testing, the whole gamut of people that are involved in the stakeholder bringing a product from design to realization. And in the spirit of that theme of transformation, I had the privilege of moderating a panel of people that represented all parts of this really ecosystem that brings us all together. And we're going to show you that panel in just a moment. We also did roll out Altium Designer 19. Both these products are slated to come out around December, January timeframe. So just stay connected with us and we'll be sure to let you know when those are coming out. Now we're going to cut to a panel discussion I led, like I said, with a group of illustrious leaders, thought leaders in their respective spaces. I hope you enjoy the panel. We'll see you on the other side. I'm going to let the panel each introduce themselves so you know who they are and give some context to their expertise. So, Tara, let's start with you.
Is working? Yes. Great. Okay. So I'm Tara Dunn with OmniPCB. We are a manufacturer's rep company specializing in printed circuit board fabrication. We represent suppliers that offer a full range of technology, so everything from very standard FR4 designs through high-end HDI. We also specialize in flex, rigid flex, and an advanced technology that's enabling sub-1 mil line in space. The company was founded on making connections, so we work very hard to connect our customers with technical information. We also work to connect our customers with others in the industry. I'm one of the founders of Geekapalooza, which is a social networking event, bringing all aspects of the electronics industry together for a night of networking. And then, of course, we work hard to connect our customers with the best fit supplier. So representing four different manufacturers with all specialized technology, together we can offer the best fit based on technology, volume, or time.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Mike Creedon. I'm the founder and now VP of San Diego PCB Design. San Diego PCB Design, actually we have a booth out there, so you can visit David and Samantha. We have 18 designers now in, I think, four or five states, and one's moving. And we have four different CAD platforms, but the one I'm excited about is Altium. And having worked for a handful of CAD companies, having bought most of the software out there, what Altium is bringing to us, I'm giving you the plug right now and the
kudos. I'm going to pay you later, Mike.
You can pay me later. This kind of event is not happening elsewhere, and the quality of education and the concept of inspiring and educating and networking is really valuable, and I request an applause for our friends at Altium. Thank you. Before I pass the mic, I have the opportunity to serve with EPTAC Corporation as a CID, CID Plus trainer. I have the designation of MIT, which is a master IPC trainer, which means I got to help write the book, along with Rick Hartley, who just spoke, Gary Ferrari, and a few others. But I have a passion for education, and I'm thankful for that opportunity. So with that, I'll pass it to Carl.
I'm Carl Schatke. I've been designing printed circuit boards for 45 years. I started when I was very young. My father was a board designer. I grew up around printed circuit boards. I'm really passionate about what we can do with printed circuit boards and helping people and enhancing their lives. I work at a very large automotive company that's smaller than the larger ones up in Silicon Valley. And I've had an opportunity to design a lot of circuit boards for cars and energy products. In my career, I've owned a consulting printed circuit board service bureau for 10 years. I also worked at Intel for almost 10 years and designed DUT boards there. And I've also done a lot of consulting on different circuit boards. I've probably designed over 4,500 circuit boards. Over my career, I've not been standing still at all. I'd love to continuously learn and work on challenging projects. And I love helping people with the design work that I do. I've really enjoyed the conference so far here and what I've learned, and I look forward to some challenging questions here.
Wow, next to Carl, I feel like a loser. I'm Julie Ellis. I'm a field applications engineer for TTM Technologies. I'm in the commercial unit, which I specialize in automotive, medical, industrial control printed circuit board design or assistance for helping customers design. TTM Technologies is the world's third largest printed circuit board fabricator. We have over 31,000 employees, 23 production facilities, and we also do some contract manufacturing. And I have experiences, I'm a BSEE, I'm a master trainer in IPC A610 and 6012, I'm a certified trainer. And I have experience in both design from when I started in design, then I moved into manufacturer's rep, so I've got a variety of experience like Judy does. I've also repped circuit boards, worked as engineer for contract manufacturers and circuit board suppliers, and now I'm here with TTM enjoying it. This has been a great show because it gives me a chance to help share knowledge and learn from all of you here, so thank you.
I'm Chris Hunrath with InSelectro. InSelectro is a material supplier to the PCB fabricators. We specialize in materials for both rigid PCB and flex, conductive inks, substrates, more recently fired on inks. But we bring the materials to fabricators like TTM. And we also specialize in quick turn, a lot of quick turn, to shorten the time to market. Hopefully we can work more with the designers in finding the right materials for the applications and solve some of the challenges you've seen and over some of the presentations today. So hopefully you can get my contact information if you need more information on materials.
Thanks. I'm going to stand up because I can't see half the people over here.
Oh, can we move that podium?
I'm not illustrious. I think the illustrious person wasn't able to be here, so Judy invited me as a last minute guest. I heard there was free food, so I agreed to come. And I want to thank Judy and Altium for putting this on. A gentleman who spoke earlier about, in the old days, well, at least when I had black hair, most of the CAD vendors and EDA vendors put on these kinds of events. And really, that's fallen by the wayside, largely, which is disappointing. I also want to thank Judy for texting me this morning at 6:45 when I was in bed in Santa Barbara telling me, oh, I was wrong. I don't need you here at noon. I need you here at 10. So thank you very much for that. I did
get him a hotel last night and invite him last night.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Craig.
So my name is Craig. We're going to have a little wrestling match later on. We might actually have it in front if you want to see it. My name's Craig. I'm a consultant. Somebody once told me that a consultant means you con and insult people all at the same time. I'm not sure what other consultants do. What qualifies me to be a consultant is I raised 5 kids, 4 of them teenage girls. If you've ever survived a teenage girl times 4, then you deserve to be illustrious in some sense. I've run a very large PCB design company forever ago. That was sold to Flextronics, and I got my first introduction to working for a $1 billion company. I got fired. Then I started a manufacturing company because I decided manufacturing can't be that hard. And I found something that can consume money at a ferocious rate. That was sold to a private equity company, and then I got fired. Then I started another manufacturing company because one wasn't enough and I still had money in my bank account. And that got sold, and then I got fired. And then I started a software company because in the manufacturing companies, there are so many holes in the process. And you're thinking about maybe Industry 4.0 and how do I get parts orientation from reels of materials to the stockroom, to the printer, to the DFM software, to layout software. Just within the manufacturing operation, there's about 6 different places that a rotation of a part is dealt with differently. So the software operation really became the most important component to the manufacturing operation. And so that's me, and thanks for the free coffee and the wake-up call at 6:45.
Yeah, you're welcome. All right, let's get started on the speed panel here. Tara, I think I'm gonna start with you. Whether we are in design, manufacturing, or any other discipline, we are all working to create the same outcome, a product. Why then do you think we seem to operate in silos, and what causes that?
That's an excellent question. Short, quick answer, it's really easy to operate that way and just keep throwing things over the fence. But I think a lot of it goes down, or comes back to, you know, having information about all of the other processes, the ones before you and the ones after you. You know, going back to the old days, as we're talking about, you know, there used to be a lot of captive shops back in the old day. So you just naturally had a better understanding of the full process from beginning to end as you would help solve problems. As that kind of went by the wayside, we started outsourcing more and specializing more. But even then, that was before email and communicating in that manner. So we would pick up the phone and talk to each other. It was very common to have field trips. You know, you go visit your contract manufacturer, the designers would come in to see the fabrication process, get to learn kind of the pain points on both sides of that equation and get to know each other. You know, once you have a problem, it's really easy to solve it once you've built a relationship. But then as the economy kind of did a downturn, those travel budgets got cut drastically, and about that same time, the area of email came into play. So now we're not traveling to see each other, we're not learning the pain points that each other's having, and we're not even talking on the phone. Probably 95% of the communication is via email, so I think it's really easy, you know, to just get in that habit and throw your problem, you know, to the next step before you or trace it back to the step behind you instead of just picking up the phone, talking to each other and solving the problem.
Thank you. Good answer. Why don't you hand the mic there to Mike Creedon. Mike, same question.
Well, it's definitely something that we as an industry are up against. Having started in 1976, I designed and we had our own fab shop and we had our own assembly shop. But the evolution of our business, as Tara alluded to, OEMs are not CMs anymore. Okay, and so we're fragmented as an industry, and now even the design comes to a company oftentimes like mine. So I think it's a flawed construct to say that we're all on the same team. And the reason I say that is because we all have our own profit centers, okay? And an example of that might be where an assembler says, gee, if I could get 10 boards up on one assembly array, that would be really good for my cost margin. However, if I go over to a fabricator, and I've actually watched Julie do this at Apex, she just sits down and breaks out, Quick Fit, and she says, yeah, but 10 would maybe good for the assembler, but you're gonna get a very low fabrication yield. So then she would have to raise her prices. So she then works across the aisle to the other person and tries to find the compromise. So the thing we really need to do, again, to echo what she said, is to build relationships back and forth. And their business relationships, understand what the other person has, and work with them and make it a team, because we're really not showing up as a team member. So it's kind of like when you talk about baseball and they show up for the All-Star game. They're competitors, but when they play together on the All-Star team, they all have the same uniform.
Great. Julie, I'm going to ask you, the next question is, if you could ask for just one thing from the discipline person company kind of adjacent to you, meaning you're in the fabrication space, so from a designer, fabricator, supplier, assembler, if you could ask just one thing from that person or company in an adjacent discipline, what would it be? No pressure.
No pressure. Because I have a lot of things that I'd like to ask for. Tara made a good point about how people just lob things over the fence. And so mine has to do kind of with that, in that everybody kind of wants to lump technology, printed circuit boards, into one group. So I'll get a director of sales, send me an email, and it'll say, hey, can you send the design guideline, your DFM guidelines to this customer? It's a new customer I don't know. I don't know what their technology is. I don't know whether they're ITAR and have to be built here in the United States, or if they're going to be prototyped here and then transferred over to China. So what I'd like everybody to do is pay more attention to detail and provide more attention, starting with customer, part number, and attach the drawings so that I really have information to answer the questions. It helps all along, because in most cases, not necessarily design guidelines for new customers, but if you're asking me for a stack up for a particular part and you think my company has the fab drawing, please send me the fab drawing, because it's difficult for me to chase it down. So I guess that was two things. Provide as much detail as possible, because it makes our jobs easier to answer the inquiries.
Thank you.
Chris Hunrath, same question. If you could ask for one thing, you're supplying materials, what would you ask of designers and fabricators, because you sort of stand in the mix of that company? What is one thing you would ask of those people?
Yeah, so I think I can answer this pretty simply. Very often, the fabricator is between us and the designer or the end customer, and a lot of times they purchase materials from us and they don't get what they expect. When I say they, I'm not talking about the fabricator, of course. I'm talking about the user of the product. So what we've been doing more recently in the last couple of years is we've been reaching out to designers and OEMs and trying to work with the fabricator. We don't want to connect to that community without the fabricator, because the fabricator has to build the parts. So we want to do it together. So really my question would be is, or not my question, request would be, is get us involved early on so we can find the best fit. Because we have a lot of different products in a lot of different spaces. And it's actually a good time to be a material supplier, because just regular epoxy FR4 isn't cutting it in a lot of designs anymore.
Thank you, great answer. So because Altium now publishes a podcast and I have the privilege of hosting that, I was interviewing Lee Ritchie, who says what he thinks. And that's why we kind of love Lee Ritchie, right? So, he said something in the podcast recently I'd like you to respond to. He said, by definition, standards are based on the past. So my question is, how do we keep pushing forward cutting-edge technology if we're using standards that are based on the past? Mike Creedon, why don't you take that one?
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this. I serve on the Standards Committee, and Lee is very correct. You are not going to innovate per the standards. You're just not going to do it. But if you truly want to build one of these, and you want to build a million of them or a billion of them, you better understand what the standards are, because they're a legal binding entity that you request performance on. And if you want to produce this in a high volume with truly what they say, producibility, you want a high yield, which lowers your cost, okay? You don't want to get operated or fly in a plane that's built to class one. You just don't want to do it. It's life critical. So understanding what producibility matrix is what standards about. The concept that they're current, I serve on these every 2 weeks. I'm going to Chicago in 2 weeks from now on my own nickel to go there to contribute. And I sit on a panel with some 70 people from all walks of industry, from aerospace, telecommunications, fabricators assembly. I'm literally on a team with some of your people from Ohio, type of thing. I know Chris is contributing right now to the 2221 series, which is a design standard. So they are current, but they're what we're currently doing. So you're not going to innovate to them. Now, I have a very important update to share with this particular body concerning that. We stood here a year ago and we got to listen to Mr. Happy Holden share about landless vias. He had done this in years past at HP and was very successful with it. HP built their own boards, therefore it was their proprietary information. And guess what? Now Happy moved on to other, companies. But that technology of landless vias died on the vine, and nobody's doing it. Now, if I was to have listened to what he said, designed a board, and then just went to Julie and said, can you build it for me? She'd go, not so readily. Okay, whether or not the technology is viable or not, I'm contracting her to a certain standard, which inhibits that. Now, here's where this gets better. I had the opportunity to work with Barry and the team at iConnect 007, and at Apex, we did a HDI roundtable. Happy and I sat down with some of their editors, and it's on the link there, so there's my plug for 007. But as a result of that interview, I took it to the technical advisory committee, and I put Gary Ferrari in charge of it, which Gary's like a pit bull when it comes to IPC. He can make things happen. They said, this is incredible. We need to be researching it and doing it, okay? So they therefore went to the 6012 committee, and they have found volunteers to do it. See, there's the problem, is people want to talk about it, but no one wants to spend their own money to go investigate this. We got volunteers to do it. We're actually in 2 weeks in Chicago going to bring our findings back. And the goal is the standards helps us share. The true thing that stifles the ingenuity and the creativity oftentimes is competitive edge. I don't want to share that. Whereas the standards body gives us the ability to share this. I don't know about you, but I want the ability to use a landless vias because the technology is going in that direction. And my applaud to Happy for helping keep this alive because he's done a very good job at that. So thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Pass the mic there to Tara. Tara, same question. You're involved in advanced technologies, particularly additive technologies that are really exciting. So how do we drive this kind of technology forward when there's not a standard in place and we need to be innovating?
Yeah, so a couple of the things that I work with are at a stage that are truly just innovative and a lot of testing, and there really aren't standards to surround that. That would be semi-additive, modified semi-additive, substrate-like PCBs, doing a lot of work in the sub 1 mil line in space, down to 5 microns. We don't have reliability data yet on those types of designs. Also, the same thing for e-textiles. We're seeing the very same thing, trying to combine the textile industry with our electronics. So I think what's important in those cases is to really sit down and be very clear about the expectations from both sides, or anybody that's involved with it, and have very frank, maybe difficult discussions about what those expectations are. Identify where the challenges are going to be in the process, and then at those challenge points, review again. Did we meet the expectations? If we didn't, why not? Is it possible to make adjustments or not? And where are we going to go from there? And as long as we keep working together and being very clear about the expectations, I think eventually those expectations is what helps build the framework for future standards.
Thank you, Tara. Well, Craig, I intentionally saved you for this question, and you sort of alluded to it before. So Craig was CEO of an EMS company in Silicon Valley that I had the privilege of visiting, and I was so impressed by what they'd done with software. And I'll just let Craig talk about it, but it's like the impact sort of well, let me just frame up the question. This, in that factory, there was so much impact of getting human hands off the boards and optimizing the process because they spent millions of dollars writing custom software to enable that. So, Craig, what impact do you think Industry 4.0 or AI or machine learning may have on the future of electronics realization?
Thanks, Judy. Again, I just can't sit here and not see half the people.
Thank you. I'm sorry about that podium.
That's okay. So as Judy mentioned, the last operation I ran was about 350 people and close to $100 million in revenue in Silicon Valley. You know, what I usually say about business in Silicon Valley, not that wherever you are from is not similar, but if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. Within about 50 miles of our building, which was 50,000 square feet, there was about 200 competitors, ranging from billion-dollar companies down to mom and pops that are just barely hanging in there. So that's a very tough environment to be in. And we talk about how many people have heard about Industry 4.0? You know, it's advertised like crazy. What does that really mean? So it's an effort. If you think about the factory floor, we have a stencil printer. It has certain parameters it needs. It has a certain job it does. Then you have a solder paste inspection machine. It has its functions and job and needs data and provides data. Then you have placement machines, then you have ovens, then you have AOI machines, then you have X-ray machines. And scattered among there, you have in human beings, quality inspectors, first article inspectors, through-hole people. So if you think about all those different machines who are all mostly made by different manufacturers, trying to create some software backplane over the top of that, so that you can collect data from the stencil printer, and data from SPI, and data from the placement machines, when each of those manufacturers either A, doesn't want to provide it because it's a secret, or the format it comes out in, it was never meant to be digested by a piece of software. But the way the stencil printer does it, and the way the SPI machine does it, and the AOI machine, and the X-ray machine, and the placement machine, and the people, everything is different. So Industry 4.0 is essentially trying to wrestle all the manufacturers to create a common software backplane so that all the machines can talk together to do within the factory what Altium is trying to do with software for the design community, to try to create some homogeneous integration from the time you design until you fabricate and assemble, so the data is transported, the necessary data is transported in a manner that's usable so it can affect the downstream process. I just got utterly frustrated at Industry 4.0. You can see why I get fired a lot. I call it Industry 0.5. They are not even close yet to these machines talking. So the most important tool in our factory was a software team that we built just to write interface code to talk to each of those machines, to normalize the data, to bring it up to a higher layer so we could collect, analyze, and predict where errors were going to be. So essentially, the industry is moving, and one of the other panel members mentioned this. The needs of a manufacturer and the constraints of a manufacturer versus a fabricator versus a material supplier versus a design software company versus designers, we all have we obviously have a common goal to get a product out, but very disparate needs and wants and challenges. And so when you try to get all of those people together to try to do things in a way that the data is transportable, that's a tough, tough problem. And we're getting there. Industry 4.0 is getting there. I guess I'll call it 1.0 now, or 1.5. Standards bodies are catching up rapidly, because why is that? Customers are making that happen. We expect to be able to get a product out very rapidly and in people's hands and sold. So we can either continue that effort at the standards level and at the innovation level, or we can be out of business. We can be the dinosaurs.
Thank you. Carl, same question. What do you think the impact of Industry 4.0 or machine learning may have on the future of electronics?
So, when I was at Intel, they have like 24 large fabs around the world, and they're approximately the size of this building, and they're filled with multiple million-dollar machines, floor to ceiling, is almost as far as the eye can see. And in this factory, there's these things called FOUPs. They're basically boxes that hold wafers, and each of those boxes is holding, you know, a couple $1 million worth of product, and there's literally thousands of them floating around the room. And the only people that are in that fab are the people that are fixing a machine that's down or servicing a machine that needs some help. So I would say they're already at that level. The rest of us that are building circuit boards aren't there yet. The volumes aren't there to justify that in the profit margins, but they will be. But I don't think that's where I want to go with this question. The question is, how do you use AI to get to the next level? And to me, that next level is taking what you know, and then, you know, that's your 2B, that's your as-is state, and then moving to a 2B state. And when you want to improve process, that's what you're always doing. So you look at the process you have, and then you look at the process where you want it to be. And then you look at what are the options that you have to get it there. And you try to design a path of migration from that as-is to the 2B state. And you look for ways that you can leverage what you have, and then you leverage that into something that's going to be super useful in, you know, using creative ways to get there in a shorter path. And you look at the activities that it takes to do one thing, and then you look at what you could automate to get to the next level. And in our software, we've seen it migrate, you know, from just simply putting tracks and pads down to, you know, now we're adding signal integrity. We're adding so many things now. If you look at where Altium has migrated over the 30 years, I started mid-85 using Altium. If you look at where that's come, each year there's a new development, there's new automation, and that automation is driven by you. You ask for things, and then Altium responds, and they respond to what's needed in the marketplace, and we have a large influence on the design of that, and Altium is really our partner in this, and there are, you know, and we're, they don't have, you know, they're not in a vacuum. They need us to help them. But where I see this going is we're looking at usage models. How are people using the software? You track how people are using the software. You track where they're taking their time, and as all, I think you could add in tracking software, you see actually where are the keystrokes being done, where are people hesitating in the designs, you know, where are the pain points? And then you eliminate those pain points and you get better and better and better software. And eventually you can automate tasks that seem mundane now, you know, like you can drive innovation in the automation, and as you come up with ideas about how something could be automated, you put the resources towards that automation, and then you're going to see increased utilization of the resources, and ultimately the human resource is the most limited one. There's only so many designers in this room, and there's only so many good designers. You look around the industry, the hardest thing for you and your business is finding more talented people. It's the same thing in our design team. We have a very difficult time finding super talented people, and the way that you do that is you train and educate, and I think that AI 4.0 is going to educate people better, and then it's going to also enable, the tools need to come up to where we educate through the usage of the tool, and then also the tool automates functions that are repeatable. I like to say that computers should do things that computers should do, and our software should help us with that, and then humans should be able to make the decisions and be helped to make the decisions that are, you know, like design direction. And we'll see increased software to help that in the future. And I think that we're going to see, you know, to me, AI is going to be used to really enhance the way that we can learn and the way that we can work in the future. That's what I hope, and I'm quite certain that we'll see that. And the companies that support that and drive that innovation are going to be, you know, some of the largest companies in the world, because they'll be far more efficient than those that sit by the sidelines and let somebody else do the work.
Thank you. Julie, TTM has factories offshore, and they're trying to get human hands off as much as possible for efficiency. Where do you think we're going to go and with Industry 4.0 from your perspective and what you're seeing in China and how some of those things might migrate to North America?
Well, what I see in China is the lines are often much larger than they are here because they're doing such big volume. So a lot of the equipment is more highly automated with loaders from one location to another. It'll go from one major process, like the develop, etch, and strip process, through a window into another process without any human hands. And I can see if we can take the data that we're for me it's a sensor issue, or you know, how do we actually inspect and then record that inspection so that from point to point we're collecting more data to find out, like Carl said, where our weaknesses are, and so that we can start attacking those. The best way to work on continuous improvement is track your top, you know, where most of your failures come from, and go back and fix those problems. And I can see all this 4.0 taking this kind of data so that we can start using that data better to attack our problems and maintain continuous improvement.
Thank you. All right, here's an intentionally sticky question, but I'm gonna throw this one to Craig. Brands like Amazon, Uber, Airbnb have altered the landscape of their respective markets. What kind of things or activities might enable us to do the same thing in our industry, allowing us to usher in a new era of electronics realization? No pressure.
No problem. Well, one of the speaking from the manufacturing perspective, which is one step down from where most of this audience is, if you look at just in California, the number of manufacturing factories, EMS companies, and EMS is a pretty broad term. You know, Foxconn is a gigantic EMS, and a mom and pop that's got a placement machine that's on a table that's vibrating when it's moving is also an EMS. If you take that whole universe and all the capacity that universe has, just in California, there's over 300 operations doing that. If those machines are running 24/7, you have 100% utilization. And usually the machines are the most expensive capital expense that the company has. We had, my last operation had four lines at $1.5 million each. I equate how much it costs to how big of an airplane could get bought with that $1.5 million. In actual fact, the capacity utilization is probably on the order of 5% if you just aggregate it all over the map. And that's somewhat of a gut feeling. I don't have any data to back that up, other than standing in factories and doing tours and watching and not seeing placement machines moving. So if you think about that and you think about Uber or Airbnb, any of the cloud-based crowdsourcing type software platforms that basically connect end users directly to the deliverers of the product, right? So if and we've a few times in the manufacturing business attempted to figure out a way to do this quite unsuccessfully. One huge area of efficiency gain, although it's yet to be determined how you work out the business issues among all these suppliers, but essentially there's a ton of unused capacity just sitting there doing nothing, waiting for the next job. So that's not good for anybody, right? And so that is a huge area of opportunity. And I actually have to credit the editor, Mike Buto. We were talking about this at One Apex one time. You ought to start a company doing, those are easy words to say. Doing it's another thing altogether. So that is one huge area. I don't think that necessarily translates directly in the design world, because really you've got a shortage of qualified, awesome designers. The tools are getting extremely complicated. The products are getting extremely complicated. So you don't just go to drafting school and learn how to run tape anymore. It's a very difficult process. So I don't know that applies there, but certainly anywhere there's manufacturing, and certainly from the EMS perspective that I have a fair amount of recent experience in, there's just a ton of unused capacity that's doing nothing. And if we could aggregate that so that you drop common data into the cloud, and the line that's closest to you or the most appropriate from a technology perspective is available, and the button gets pressed and the things get made, that's going to be a huge leap in efficiency.
Thank you. All right, we have time for one more. Carl, you work at an electric car company whom we shall not name. And
I have one of those.
That's very innovative and known for their innovation. So same question, brands like Amazon, Uber, Airbnb, SpaceX, you know, to take it into the manufacturing side or the OEM side, is they've altered the landscape and broken the rules, but are very effective. So what things might we do in our industry overall to make us all that kind of, you know, break some barriers?
So there's one common thing between Amazon, Uber, and Airbnb, is they have increased resource utilization. So the resources in Amazon were warehousing and product delivery. In Uber, it was availability of transportation services. In Airbnb, it was availability of bed space. Basically, they've massively increased the amount of available places to get some rest at night. It used to be you had to stay at a hotel like this, but now with Airbnb, you can get on an app and find 100 times more places to rest your head at night. But it essentially boils down to resource utilization. And the question is, how do we apply that to what we're doing? So how can we better utilize the resources that we have? There's a term called design reuse. Okay, we see that in layer stackups, like we talked about yesterday. That's we're reusing a layer stackup. We've saved ourselves some time. If we boil it down to our design terms, which is, we're designers. That's what we're trying to do. As Altium's looking to migrate forward, what's the right path? It's to look at areas where you have a resource that isn't getting properly utilized. So, as designers, we know that we're being maxed out on our utilization. We're being asked to work extra hours or find, more quicker ways to do things and get more done in the same amount of time. So look at where we're wasting time. It's probably in email. It's probably in meetings that we don't need to be attending. It's probably in useless requests that don't add benefit to the end customer. It's probably in requests to do things that are out of our area of expertise. So we're working outside the boundaries we should be in. So at a personal level, we're going to be the Uber of ourselves, and look to utilize our limited resource, which is time, more effectively in the design work that we do. And anything that Altium does to help us manage our time better and utilize that limited resource, ultimately that's the one resource none of us have extra of or more of or less of. We all have to manage what we have, and we're all more effective by how well we use that time we have. So if the tool can help us do things in a quicker way, we're going to be way more effective as designers, and we'll be on to the next project and building the last one quicker. There'll be a product ready faster when we get faster. Okay. Otherwise, we got to just wait for the same path of speed. And the goal to me is to increase the speed at which we can design, so we can go design some more stuff. And that's going to happen as the tool improves. We've already seen that happen, but we're going to continue to move that path forward. And when we looked at the slide earlier about what was the most important thing, 9 out of 10 wanted higher productivity out of the tool. That was the takeaway I had from that slide that Lawrence showed earlier. And that is where we want to move as an industry, is faster, better, more efficient. Because if a computer can do it, I don't want to be doing it. If it's going to do a fine job with it, let's get there. If I'm not afraid of an auto router. If the auto router does it, great. I'm still going to be needed to conceptualize what I want that thing to do. I'm not worried about being out of a job by a computer. I'm worried about, there not being enough resources to go tackle all the projects that we want to get done. Mm-hmm. I need tools that are, super effective so that I can go do more stuff. That's what I enjoy doing, and it's where I'm best. And if the tool can help me do that better, then that's the most awesome thing, is getting a tool that's organized to help me be more organized and effective with the limited resource I have, which is the time in the design seat.
Thank you all for doing this in such a quick way. These are thought-provoking answers you've given us. And Altium, we want to keep having this conversation. This is just a taste, an appetizer, and we want to continue to have this conversation with you as well. So thank you all for being here, for offering your expertise. Thank you so much. Let's all give them a hand, please. Well, we hope you enjoyed that panel discussion. And what we want you to know is this was not a one-off conversation. We want to continue to have these conversations with our design community and with Altium user community. So please comment, let us know, email us. We want to continue this conversation of how to make things work better for you. So we hope you enjoyed that. On the website, which is altium.com/AL18, we're going to be posting all of our keynote talks, all of our speakers, and we will have an absolute glut of material for you to review, see. So if you weren't able to join, you will be able to see our keynotes and so much more. So we invite you to, again, visit altium.com/AL18. We'll miss you for these 6 weeks, but we'll see you on the other side. Until then, remember to always stay on track.